All right, let's do a couple of housekeeping things first. If you go to the site, this is not the site live, but it looks just like that. I've made it a little prettier. Initially, I was just going to list all the files. So if you go to this website, thebible.net/EDWG, that stands for Everyday with God. This is what you'll see. Again, this is playing off my computer. And so when you click the link for welcome, it goes to the message that used to be there. So if you click this link, this explains how everything works. If you click the link in the middle that says class files, you can click either the word class files or you can click the picture. You're going to see all the stuff with one exception loaded already. In fact, I already linked tonight's class, which is kind of interesting because I'm doing tonight's class now. So I didn't pre-record it. But all of these links on the top are all active. So there are two forms of the Everyday with God notes that are the introductory. This is the original, and then I'm reformatting it. Last week's class is already up. Last week's audio is already up. And all the sermon slides are up. Today, everything's up. I've linked tonight's class, but I haven't done. But the notes from Genesis, I'm finishing editing. So I'm going to put that up hopefully later tonight. But this morning's class is already up. This morning's sermon's already up. And the slides from last week and this week, we only got through about a third of the slides last week, but they're all up, and all the slides from this morning, they're up. So you're going to see we had five different links from last week. We only have four this week. Depending on whether or not we continue into another chapter, we'll have 3 to 5 links every week throughout the course of the year. And we'll add extra files as they are necessary. I mentioned this already. If you click the far link that has the pencil tips, that's why it's called reading tips, you will see different links to different files that might be beneficial to you. And I will add that over the course of the year so that there will be a longer list. And so the Bible reading schedules that I mentioned before that I've created, that others have created, Skip Andrews, who preached for a long time at the Duluth congregation, did a chronological Bible reading schedule and some notes on how to study the Bible. That's all going to be there. So again, if you just remember to go to thebible.net, EDWG, you're going to see all those files there. And with the exception of the class notes on Genesis, which I'm editing, everything is already up. All right? Questions or comments? Yes, Carol.
Okay. And this is going to be probably one of those stupid questions, but...
If it's important to you, it's important.
Okay. Where did the people come from? I mean, we got Adam and Eve.
All right.
We got Cain and Abel.
We'll get to that later.
Oh, okay. So this is...
No, that's all right. We didn't talk about it this morning. And there, let me just simply say, when we are studying each week or each Sunday morning class and Sunday evening class like tonight, we're going through 10 to 12 chapters at a time. So we're only spending 4 or 5 minutes roughly on each chapter, which is not fair from one perspective, but we're not just reading it to read it. And then the notes are there, and then the audio's up there after the fact. So let me simply say, we will not be able to answer every question that you have. But we'll try to answer some of them. I'll deal with that at the beginning of the class. Thank you so much for asking that. Any other questions or comments? Evelyn.
This app that I got is a nice way if you want to keep track of your phone and reading.
Oh, yes. I didn't mention that. I mentioned the ESV app that you can read and have it read to you at the same time. But I didn't mention that. You might mention the name of that. And I'll put a link to that on the Bible reading tips before. And if there are other things that you find that are useful that will help you in your reading, and there are multiple utilities that are out there that will help you read through the Bible and that will read it audibly, I mean, that will read it out loud audibly for you as you're reading it. So I'll add the one Evelyn's talking about. It's a schedule that's online that you can just click the links when you download the app. Right, and then the reading schedules that we mentioned before, if you don't have one, they're linked at the page, and then I have some copies of the physical printed schedule that are here. All right, and there are a few copies of the handouts of just introduction to Bible study that we did last week. I have a few copies of that left up here as well. But from, you know, as much as possible, everything that we discuss digitally in class, or that we discuss in class, will be available digitally, either in audio or print form online. All right? Does that make sense? And so the only thing that's not up there when you go to the link in class files is the class notes on Genesis. And so we'll be in Genesis for the next week or so when you look at the schedule. I think we get out of Genesis in about the 18th of the month. So we're going to be there for the next couple of weeks anyway. So these notes for Genesis will last from today, this week, and I think we'll run out just about here. And so then the class notes for Exodus will be up. So I will post those as we're getting to them all the time. And occasionally I may have an original, like this is the stuff that I scan, and then I'm re-editing it as I go along the way, at least making it a little bit cleaner looking. And then over time I will eventually rewrite all of this. All right, so let's dig into where we left off this morning. We got up to the book of Genesis, and we finished chapter 11. And again, we went through it very quickly. I want to start in chapter 12. Let me address what Carol mentioned just a few moments ago. When you see what happens in the beginning, God created man and woman in his image. Adam and Eve are mentioned specifically by name in Genesis chapter 3. And then in Genesis chapter 4, we see the origin of their children. Cain and Abel are mentioned specifically. And as you read through the text, you obviously know what happened, that Cain killed his brother Abel. And then in the following chapters, Eve gave birth to another child named Seth. And she says, I've begotten a man from the Lord. In effect, he becomes a de facto replacement for Abel because he was righteous. And then after that, it says, Adam and Eve had other sons and daughters. How many did they have? Don't know. You know, that's not told us. Now, let me simply mention this, and this is not intended to be a perfect explanation. Adam and Eve and Methuselah and a number of the characters are mentioned in the early chapters. When I say characters, I mean individuals. I don't mean anything negative by that. Lived for hundreds of years, and they had children through the course of those hundreds of years. And so if the Brad family that we know, members of the body of Christ, have eight children, well, if Renee and Steve and Brad lived to be 1,000 years old and they had children, you know, at the rate they're having them now, they might have hundreds of children, all right? And that's not anything negative. I'm simply saying because man lived longer, men and women lived longer because the deleterious effects of sin didn't shorten their lives immediately, they were having children much, much longer. And so they had larger families. And so the earth became populated that much more quickly because of that. So question that was brought up. Well, Cain left and Cain married somebody. Well, who did he marry? We don't see anything else about anybody else living on the earth prior to that point. But it doesn't say how long after he left that he married somebody. Because of the original couple that existed, Adam and Eve, and then Cain and Abel, and then Seth mentioned by name, and other sons and daughters whose names are not mentioned in the text, that the earth would have been populated with many more people who were descendants of Adam and Eve, some of whom Abel, had he lived, would have married, or Cain, because he did live, married, and then later Seth. So they were marrying members of their immediate family at that point because there wasn't any hereditary genealogical things, genetic things, not genealogical things, that would have made it taboo as it is in society today. So at some point, Cain married somebody who was somehow or another related to him. One quick thing to make a point, when we read about Abraham that we're reading about in just a little bit here, Abraham was married to Sarah. Was Sarah related to him? Sister. Yes, all right? She was a half-sister. So they shared one parent, but not two parents. Well, in that particular, you know, time frame, that was something that was acceptable. There are laws against marrying within families, you know, today because lots of things have changed. So in answer to Carol's question, briefly, without going into a lot of detail, at some point when Cain married somebody, he married somebody that was in some way related to him. Exactly how were they related, we don't know. Right? Would have been descendant of Adam and Eve. And so was it two generations different? I don't know. Let me simply say, in my own family, my first cousin was so much older than I was that her second born child was 3 months older than I am. You think, well, how did that work? Well, she had children at a much younger age, as her mother did before her, so much so that though he was my first cousin once removed, we're only 3 months different in age. And so you multiply lots of people having lots of children and that kind of dynamic and so forth, at some point there's going to be an intergenerational marriage as well as intrafamilial marriage. All right, I don't know if that explains everything, but at least that's the basic start of it. And there's more to tell about that. All right, yes.
The same thing would have happened after the flood with Noah's family.
And that's an excellent point as well. And so when the population restarted, After the flood, Genesis chapter 9, the same sort of dynamic comes into play. All right?
Adam and Eve were related.
That's good. They were related. That's a very good, in a very unique way. A good point. All right. I mentioned this morning. I want to take up there in the time that we have. We mentioned how quickly the Bible moves through different topics in the beginning. In Genesis chapter 1 and 2, the creation account appears. And I mention this not at all to diminish the importance of the creation account, but to note this. The creation is nothing on the scale of what God's going to do after that. Because what God does after that is more spiritually oriented than physically oriented. And so the creation, as dramatic as it is, as climactic as it is, as demonstrative as it is of God's power and so forth, God's going to do even greater things from the standpoint of creating a people that are more like Him. The world is reflective of God's character, but not in the way that mankind is. So mankind's nature, because man was created, and when I say man, I mean mankind, man and woman, was created in God's image, is more like God than anything that God created physically. And so as we read through the account of sin, we read through the account of the second sin, that's Cain and Abel, we read through the genealogies that are going to take us to Noah, that's the flood stories in chapter 6 through 9, we go through another genealogical record that takes us to the Tower of Babel, and then we get to where we left off this morning, Abraham. And the story in the book of Genesis slows down. Why? Anytime you've read a novel, or anytime you've watched a television show, or you've watched a movie, one of the things that's done is you give background information before the main characters are introduced, and once they're introduced, the story's going to focus on them. So supporting actors and or actresses, they are supporting. They're not the main character, so they don't have as much face time as others do. Well, Abraham's face time, starting in chapter 12, is going to be much more than Adam's was, and then Noah's was, or anybody else's to this point. Why? Because of the role that God has Abraham play in his redemptive plan. We mentioned this before, that it's selective history. Who selected what was going to be recorded? God. Recorded through Moses, Genesis through Deuteronomy, or Matthew, or Mark, Luke, or John, whatever text that we're reading. God determined what's going to be recorded. According to what standards? According to how it related to God's plan to redeem man through Jesus Christ, who was his son. And so because of that, Abraham's role as a model of redemption by faith through grace, Abraham was saved, Romans chapter 4 and Romans chapter 5. Because of his model, he's going to be very, very prominent in the biblical text of the book of Genesis. In addition to that, because of the promise that God made to Abraham, there's another huge dimension that makes Abraham that much more important. We mentioned it in passing, but in the context of the flood, God made a covenant with Noah. But the covenant that God made with Noah was a physically oriented covenant, saying, I'm not going to destroy the world again by flood. And the rainbow, a physical demonstration of that, is set into the heavens in order to demonstrate that. But God makes a promise covenant with Abraham that's not just a physical covenant. It has physical components, but most importantly, it's a spiritual covenant. God says, I'm going to give you land, that's physical. I'm going to give you seed, that's children, that's physical. I'm going to bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you, that's also physical. But then there's that added dimension, and that is through you, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. That's a spiritual covenant primarily. That's what's emphasized in the book of Galatians in the third chapter. That's why Paul can say to the Jews who are members of the body of Christ in the churches of Galatia and the Gentiles who are members of the churches of Christ in Galatia, he can say this, those who are of faith are children of Abraham. What does he mean? Jew or Gentile, you could be a child of Abraham by faith. If you're going to be a child of Abraham simply physically, then the Gentiles are ruled out and only the Jews could be his physical descendants. What does that mean? They are the ones who are descendants of Abraham through Isaac through Jacob, whose name became Israel, and the 12 sons, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, all the way down to Joseph and Benjamin. But Abraham is the progenitor of salvation by faith. And so the redemptive plan of being saved by grace through faith is really going to kick into full tilt gear when you get to the story of Abraham. And so the promise of a singular seed starts in Abraham. Now, why do I say that? Because when God made this promise to Abraham, Abraham was 75 years old. When the promise is fulfilled, he's 100 years old. And his wife, who's never had children, is nearly 90 years old when Isaac is going to be born. before that, they're going to have another child by Sarah's handmaid, Hagar. And at one point, Abraham says to God, oh, that Ishmael, the son of Hagar, might walk before you, might be before you. And God says, no, it's not just that any child that's going to be the child of promise. It's a specific child. And so he says, in Isaac is your seed called. And so God made a choice. He made a seed line choice. Let me tell you how critical this is. In the book of Romans, you'll see a passage that says, Jacob have I loved, but Esau have I hated. Well, who are Jacob and Esau? They were the second generation on the other side of Abraham. You have Abraham and then Isaac, and then you have Jacob and Esau. Jacob and Esau were brothers. Jacob was the second born. But because of the uniqueness of the role that they played, Jacob became known as the supplanter, one who took the place of, because the birthright came through Jacob rather than Esau. Under the Old Testament system of law, even before you get to the law of Moses, there was the law of primogeniture, which is a fancy way of saying the law of the firstborn. Primo meaning first, geniture referring to who was begotten first. And so according to the covenants, the way things worked and in families at that day, the firstborn received a double inheritance. And so if there are three children, the firstborn gets double what the others do. So that means it's divided in four ways. The firstborn gets twice, and the others only get a quarter. And so that's the way that would work. So according to the way it would work, Esau would have gotten two-thirds of the inheritance, and his brother only got one-third because he was the firstborn. But because of the promise that was made to his mother, and because of the seed line promise that's going to end up in Christ, it worked out that Jacob is going to be the means by which this is going to take place. Now here's the point. The choice of Jacob or Esau was a seed line choice, not a heaven or hell choice. Let me mention that again. The choice between Jacob and Esau was a seed line choice, not a salvation versus condemnation choice. So when you read through the passage in the book of Romans, it says, oh, God hated Esau, and so he damned all of Esau's descendants to hell. Well, that's not a very favorable reading of God, and that's not a favorable reading of the text. What it says is in that context is God chose the seed line through whom Jesus was going to come. If you were not in the specific seed line of Christ, does that mean you're lost because you're not connected to him genealogically? No. That's the whole point of Galatians that we talked about before. If you are a child of Abraham by faith, you are saved by the blood of Jesus. Not because you are connected to Abraham in his bloodlines, but because you're connected to Abraham by faith. And so Genesis chapter 12 is a whole new dimension of what it's going to mean to become a Hebrew, a child of Israel, or a Jew. So Abraham is later referred to as a Hebrew. And the origin of that term has been debated, but there was an ancestor of hers, is known as Eber, E-B-E-R. And the assumption is that the word Hebrew is a derivation of that. But he's also often referred to as the father of Israel. But Israel is his grandson. And so Abraham is the first in a seed line that is a fulfillment of a covenant promise that's ultimately going to lead to Jesus. So how does Matthew start? Matthew. The book of the generations, the book of the genealogy of Jesus, the Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Why David? First king that's going to lead to Jesus, who's a descendant of Judah. That's what David was. But also of Abraham, because that's the person to whom the promise was made. Now let me just focus on the significance of the promise, and then we'll move a little more quickly later. On the day of Pentecost, when Peter preached the gospel in its fullest sense for the first time, I'm not saying the gospel is never alluded to before, the gospel is alluded to many times, but the fullest sense of the gospel that kicked into gear following the death, burial, resurrection, and ascension of the Christ is going to be preached for the first time 50 days after Jesus went to the tomb. All right, he goes into the tomb, he's buried for 3 days, he resurrects on the first day of the week, and 7 weeks later, plus one day, which is the 50th day, he's going to rise again from the tomb. On the day of Pentecost, the gospel is preached for in its fullest sense for the first time. What's the significance of that? The gospel is connected to the promise made to Abraham in Genesis 12, and is connected to Genesis 3:15, where it says the seed of woman is going to triumph over man. So the seed line from Eve through Abraham, and later through Isaac, and then through Jacob, and then through David, all comes into play in the New Testament. And that's why Peter cites all of that. Peter cites a promise that was made to Abraham. He cites the promise that was made to David. And he says when he gets near the end of his speech that you are convicted of Jesus' death. And when the people heard that, it says they were cut to the heart. And they said to Peter and the rest of the apostles, men and brethren, what shall we do? And it's in that context that Peter says to repent and be baptized, every one of you, in the name of Jesus Christ, for the remission of sins, and you shall receive the gift of the Spirit. That's verse 38. Now watch verse 39. And this promise is to you and to your children and all those that are far off, even as many as the Lord our God shall call. That's interesting. He referred to the gospel and the fulfillment of the preaching of the gospel and the blessings that came from it as a promise. That's exactly the language that's used with reference to Abraham. The promise of Abraham is fulfilled in Jesus, specifically in the message of Jesus as proclaimed starting on the day of Pentecost. And so you're going to see Abraham mentioned all over the New Testament, because what God starts in Abraham is finished in the New Testament, specifically in the person of Jesus. So, Genesis chapter 12, that's an incredible account to read. Now, I'm not going to go through all the dynamics of what happens when he goes into Egypt. He doesn't tell the total truth with reference to his relationship to Sarah, because he's afraid that he is going to be killed when they find out she's beautiful. And if they find out he's her husband, they're going to kill him. So he says, just say you're my sister, which was partly true, but not the whole truth. But here's something else that's interesting. When Abraham goes into Egypt, one of the things before they found out that Sarah was his wife is, so if you open your text to the book of Genesis chapter 12, you'll see that all of a sudden Abraham gets rich. But Abraham doesn't get rich because he stole anything. And he doesn't get rich because he's gone down there to do business. Incidentally, he went into Egypt because there was a famine. And so there's a dynamic that's going to be introduced here that's going to be brought out many times in Scripture about how famines move God's people from one place to another, and how all of those things are going to ultimately accomplish God's will providentially. So if you're looking at the passage in Genesis chapter 12, I don't read all of it, but there was a famine, verse 10. So Abraham went down to Egypt to be there because the famine was so severe where he was. So when they get there, he said, this is what I want you to say concerning who I am. When they see you, they're not going to kill me because you're only my sister. So Abraham went there. They found out she was beautiful. The princes of Pharaoh said that to Pharaoh, and he came to his house. Now watch, verse 16. Look at this. He, Pharaoh, treated Abraham well for her sake. Now watch the rest of that. He had sheep, oxen, male donkeys, male and female servants, female donkeys and camels. All of that came from Pharaoh, given to Abraham. Remember what the text says earlier? I'm going to bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. And so one of the ways that Abraham was blessed before they found out that she was his wife, not the sister, he gave Abraham, whom he thought was a brother, let me give you all this kind of stuff. I want you to be nice to me and I'm going to be nice to you. And so Abraham in part became wealthy because of this deception that's going on here. So he has all of these flocks. Pharaoh finds out that she's his wife and not just a sister, and then he sends him away. But what's interesting, when he sends her away, Abraham is now a wealthy man, which introduces what we're going to see in the following chapters. So Abraham's wealthy enough that he has a standing army of 318 individuals who are going to be able to fight to help free Lot and so forth. So that's what we see in the next chapter, chapter 13. So we'll segue into that. So in chapter 13, Abraham and Lot are both very successful, and there are so many in their respective entourages that they can't all stay in the same place. And so here's something about Abraham's character. He's not perfect. We saw a deception that was involved in chapter 12. But he says to Lot, you pick whatever place that you're going to go to. You go to the left, I'll go to the right. You go to the right, I'll go to the left. And so he allowed Lot to have first dibs from the standpoint of where he's going to inherit land. And where does Lot choose? He chooses land that's fully lush and that's got lots of vegetation and so forth for his cattle, and he chooses a land in the vicinity of Sodom and Gomorrah. And of course, that's going to come back in the next few chapters to be a very significant thing that's going to impact not only Lot, but also Abraham. So they separate. And God says, I'm still going to bless you. I'm going to make your land, your people as numerous as the stars in this heaven and as the dust of the earth. Both of those brought out in chapter 13 and chapter 15. Well, in chapter 14, we see a dynamic that's going on in and around where Lot and Abraham are living. So when they moved to left Ur of the Chaldees, and they came to Haran, and then they left Haran and went to the land of Canaan. It's not like they went to a place where nobody lived. There were other people that were already there. And so there are lots of different kings and so forth, and many of these were not kings of countries or huge city-states, but rather small rural kings, because you're going to see a number of them that are mentioned in this context. Kings of nations, but not nations on the scale that we are used to. And so they're fighting back and forth with each other. And in this context of their fighting, Lot and his family are taken captive. So that's the beginning of the chapter. Verse 12, they took Lot, Abraham's brother's son, which means it's his nephew, who dwelt in Sodom. They not only took Lot, they took his goods, and they took his family with them. So when news of this comes to Abraham, Abraham sends out men with him. Notice verse 14, 318 people who were servants in his household. Now, I don't know what the going rate for people who were in your employ that day, but if I had 318 employees, I'd be dead, all right? Because I couldn't take care of that. So that's an indication of something of the wealth that Abraham had, that he was able to earn enough by means of the flocks and all the things that he did, that he was able to sustain a household of 318 servants. And that's more than likely just the men who were his employee, not necessarily all their families related to that. So Abraham was wealthy. So he sends out those men, and they redeem, they capture, bring Lot back, and so forth. And then there's a dramatic thing that's introduced in verse 18 and following. And so Melchizedek, who comes out of nowhere, who is described as a king of Salem, comes to Abraham. He's described as a priest of the God Most High, and he blesses Abraham, and Abraham pays tithes to him. Now that's an interesting thing. Where did this guy come from? Don't know. He's described as the king and the priest of Salem, but in the New Testament book of Hebrews, he's a man described as having no genealogy. You might say, well, how could somebody exist without any genealogy? It doesn't mean he had no parents. It means that there's no record. That he's a one-of-a-kind person, came out of nowhere, disappears into nowhere, and he becomes a perfect example of the nature of Christ, who had no genealogy the way most people do. He had a mother who was empowered by the power of the Spirit to have a child, but he had no physical father. So Jesus' genealogy is depicted as being on par with Melchizedek's. But on top of that, Melchizedek disappears, and there's no genealogy before him, and there's no genealogy after him. And the same thing was referenced to Christ.
Yes,
he becomes a type, that is, an analogy of the nature of what Jesus was going to be. And that's a huge, huge dimension in Hebrews chapter 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. So about six chapters in a row, at least, in Hebrews, the notion of Melchizedek is significant. Now, there's something else that's important here. And it's not brought out in this chapter. Remember what we mentioned in passing very quickly this morning. There are a lot of things that are introduced in the book of Genesis that are only going to be more fully explained later. Why? It's like Genesis is prequel to the story. All right? So I hesitate using this illustration all the time, but it's very popular and everybody understands it. The first three Star Wars movies that were made were number 4, 5, and 6. You might think, well, that's the dumbest thing I ever heard of. Well, that's the way it was planned, and so Mr. Lucas, who owned it all at that time before it sold to Disney, he went back and told three stories that were prequel that set the stage for that. So everything you see in this context in the book of Genesis is setting the stage for something even greater to come. What's going to be greater to come? Abraham's descendants are going to become the nation that God promised them in Genesis chapter 12. That hasn't happened yet, but that's going to happen. Now, there are some other things that are related to that that are very important. In the book of Hebrews that I just mentioned, it speaks about how Abraham paid tithes to the Melchizedek priesthood. Now, think about this. Abraham had no children at this point. He had no son Isaac, the child of promise. He had no grandson Jacob, whose name became Israel. And he had no great-grandsons, all the sons of Jacob or Israel after that. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Dan, Naphtali, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, Benjamin, and so forth. Dan, Naphtali, I forgot those. He didn't have any of that. But what's interesting, he says, Abraham's seed, his future descendants, paid tribute to Melchizedek. And that even though they were yet unborn, it was another type of the Aaronic priesthood, which came through Levi, one of the sons of Jacob in Israel, paying tribute to Melchizedek. And the whole point of that in the book of Hebrews is that shows that Christ was a greater priest than the Aaronic priesthood. And so what does that mean? It means Christ's priesthood was on a scale well beyond anything that was going to come out under the law of Moses. So when the law of Moses kicks into gear, when we get in the book of Exodus, the people are going to be reminded about the role of priests. And having read through the book of Genesis, they're going to remember, hey, there was a priest that was a superlative priest that was even greater than Aaron as a priest. And when you get to the book of Hebrews, that's the model that's going to be brought out. Aaron's priesthood was fantastic, but it's nothing like the priesthood of Melchizedek, whose genealogy came out of nowhere, went away, and there was nobody succeeding him from the standpoint of genealogy, and that's the dimension that Jesus brings to the fore. So this chapter 12, is going to be critical. Chapter 14 is going to be critical because it all anticipates the coming of Jesus. Now, let's go to chapter 15. So Abraham was promised when he was 75. The timetable doesn't tell us in chapter 15 what's happening. But Abraham asks God, he says, you know, and I'm paraphrasing here, he says, I'm your shield, I'm your exceeding great reward. And watch what Abraham says in verse 2. What are you going to give me? I am childless. You've promised me children as numerous as the dust, as numerous as the stars, but I have no children. I've got this man who works in my employee. He's a steward, Eleazar of Damascus, and he's the one who stands to inherit everything. Is that going to be the promise? And God says, no. Watch what God says. God says, no, that's not going to be your heir, verse 4. But the heir that you're going to have, watch this, verse 4, shall come from your own body. Not just going to be somebody who works in your house. He's literally going to be your child. And so now God's going to do something that I can't do. If I promise to do something and I don't do it, and I come back and make a promise to do something else to back up the first promise, you're going to think, well, you didn't keep the first promise. How likely is it that I should believe this one? And so God makes a promise in Genesis 12, and God does something that God can do that I can't do. He backs up the promise by extending and expanding on the promise in Genesis chapter 15. So watch what he says. Verse 15, verse 5, he takes Abraham outside. He says, look at the heavens. Look at the stars. Can you count them? Can you number them? Chapter 13, he did the same thing about dust. He said, that's how many descendants you're going to have. And it says in this verse 6, Abraham believed him. And it was accounted to him for righteousness. That's the verse that we cited in the beginning of our lesson this morning in Romans chapter 4, starting in verse 23 and following. And then God says, I'm the one who took you out of Ur of the Chaldees, and I brought you this place to inherit it, and I'm going to explain how all this is going to happen. So they go through a dynamic in which the covenant is re-ratified and reinforced, and then God tells him details that he didn't tell him at first. Watch what he says. You're going to go into a country that is your descendants, verse 13, in a land that's not theirs. That's the land of Egypt. And they're going to be afflicted there. And then I'm going to bring them out after I've judged that nation, verse 14. And in the fourth generation, they're going to come back to this place. So what God does in Genesis 12, he introduces the skeletal version of the story. And when he comes back in chapter 15, he says, the descendants that I talked about before, they're going to become a nation, going to be captive in another nation, and I'm going to release them and bring them to this place. And Abraham believed all of that. So what did he do? He expanded the first promise with even more promises in support of that, and Abraham believed that. Now, drop down to chapter 16. So here's the dynamic that's interesting. Was Abraham perfect? No. Did Abraham have faith? Yes. Did Abraham know everything that God had in mind? Only as God revealed it, and sometimes he had to reveal it slowly because sometimes Abraham might miss something. He just told him, it's not going to be this man who works in your house. It's literally going to be your child. So he doesn't have any children yet. And so in Genesis chapter 16, as he's talking with his wife, Sarah says, I don't have any children. I've got this woman who's a handmaiden. She's an Egyptian. And under the way the rules of domestic things that happened at that time, Abraham could have a child by her, and it would be considered his child and her child because it was her handmaid. And so Abraham has a child by means of Hagar, as if that child's going to fulfill the promise. And so the dynamic that goes on in this chapter is such that when the child, she is pregnant by Abraham, Sarah is very jealous of that, and he sends the woman away, and he says, you know, this child's not going to be the child of promise. It's going to be literally a child of yours and Sarah's. So chapter 17, when Abraham's 99 years old, God says the child of promise has not yet been born. And Abraham's stunned. Wait a minute. I done did already had a child. All right? Can't that child be the child of promise? And God says, no, that's not going to be the child of promise. And so we see, he says, a year from now, you and Sarah will have a child. And when Abraham hears it, he's not quite sure what to believe. And when Sarah is told about this later in chapter 18, she laughs. And Isaac's name, Yitzhak, means laughter. Laughter, all right? And so God reminded him, you can imagine, for the rest of their lives, when they call that boy's name, they're called to mind what their initial response was. We laughed at God when God said this was going to happen. So his name was a constant reminder of that. We see that in verse 17 of chapter 17. Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, shall a child be born to a man who's 100 years old? He's 99 when he says a year from now you're going to have a child. He says, how can that be? I'm going to be 100 when this comes about. And then on top of that, he says, and what about Sarah? She's 90 years old, never had children, and now you're going to say she's going to have children. I don't understand that. All right? So God says you are going to have a child. Sarah, your wife, is going to bear you a son, verse 19, and you're going to call his name Isaac, again, which means laughter. And then I'm going to establish my covenant with him. Watch. The covenant that God makes with Abraham in Genesis 12 becomes a national covenant in the space of three generations. Abraham, and the next is Isaac, and then Jacob. Jacob's name was changed to Israel, one who strives with or a prince of God. And Israel became a name not only of a man, but of a family and eventually a nation, because Jacob, Israel, had 12 sons, each of whom became their own progenitor of a huge tribe in the nation of Israel. And so Abraham, within three generations, is not just going to be a man with a son, but a man with a son and a grandson after Abraham's gone, who's going to develop into a huge nation that's ultimately going to be enslaved in Egypt. And that promise that was made to Abraham becomes not an individual promise, but a national promise. And so all the promises made to Abraham are going to be just as dramatic three generations later, especially when you get to the end of the book of Genesis and the beginning of the book of Exodus. And Exodus opens with the whole story of the nation of Israel. Well, what's the big deal about them? They are the logical continuation of the promise and the covenant that God made to Abraham back in Genesis 12. Only now it's not one person, it's a nation. When they left the land of Egypt, there were 603,550 men of fighting age, not counting the men who were not numbered, who were too young or too old or were infirm or were priests, and not counting the women and children. So how large was the nation? We don't know. The estimates have ranged from 2 to 5 million. So Abraham was told, you're going to have a large number of people. You know, if I told you that 200 years from now, your family tree is going to incorporate 2 million people, you might think, it's not possible. All right? You know, that's just a lot of folks. You know, imagine keeping up that with your ancestry.com, you know, records. That would drive you crazy. The point is that they grew dramatically, and that's exactly what God promised. So the dimension that starts with Abraham is going to grow exponentially in the next few hundred years to the nation that's going to develop in the land of Israel, in the land of Egypt, to be known as the nation of Israel. So drop down to chapter 17. God is now going to institute this principle of circumcision, which is described as a sign of the covenant. And it's a physical sign of a spiritual aspect. Now, I'm going to back up just a little bit to Genesis chapter 12. In the opening verses of Genesis chapter 12, before God tells Abraham that I'm going to bless you, before he says I'm going to give you land, and before he says I'm going to give you seed, and before he says I'm going to bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you, the first words after God appeared to him, he says, get out of your country. Leave your family, your kindred, your father's house, and go to another land. And so I've often summed that as the get up, get out command. What's he saying? You need to leave where you are. Before the promise was ever made, God's command to Abraham was, you need to leave where you are. Because as we see in the book of Joshua, chapter 24, 15, but also the beginning of the verses, Abraham's ancestors worshipped other gods. That's why Joshua said to the children of Israel, choose this day whom you're going to serve. Are you going to serve the gods of our father Abraham? What? You know, Abraham's ancestors were involved in paganism. They worshiped a multiplicity of gods. And so one of the reasons why Abraham was to distance himself from them so that their influence was not going to corrupt Abraham or his descendants. So Abraham had to leave. Now watch what we see in beginning of Genesis chapter 17. We're going to see another get up, get out moment. When Abraham was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abraham and said to him, I am Almighty God. Watch this. Walk before me and be blameless. He asks Abraham, there's a character trait I want you to develop. The first one is, I want you to leave these, you know, these people who are worshiping all these different gods. So you leave them. You separate yourselves from them. You sanctify yourselves from them. And then in this context, he says, be blameless. Walk before me, be blameless. And then God says, and I will make my covenant between me and you and will multiply you exceedingly. So the covenant that God gave Abraham back in Genesis chapter 12 and in Genesis 15 and in Genesis 17 and later is a covenant of righteousness, not just land, not just seed, not just stuff and blessings. It's a covenant of righteousness. Now what's the significance of that? The significance of that, as the nation of Israel developed historically, they focused more on the land and more on their size and their seed and their kings and the physical stuff they had, and they forgot about God's covenant of righteousness. When God says, walk before me and be blameless, and I will keep this covenant with you, the whole point was their righteousness was a precursor to their blessings. They weren't righteous. God's going to remove them from the land, and that's exactly what happened. Now, very quickly, let me encourage you to turn to the book of Luke. And I have a large article or two or three pages that I've written about this that I'll post on the site later if I remember. And if I forget, you let me know. Incidentally, if you see any links that don't work at what I've told you before, let me know and I'll fix those. I tried to check them all multiple times today. So in Luke chapter 1, the birth of John is introduced, and the circumstances surrounding his birth and Elizabeth's pregnancy and Mary going to visit her and so forth. What happens when his father, John's father, is in the temple and he's speechless for a while because he doesn't initially believe the angel that comes to him. So after John is born and his name is given, his father, Zechariah, begins to speak. That starts in verse 67. Now his father, that's Zechariah, father of John, filled with the Holy Spirit, he begins to prophesy. Now watch what Zechariah says. Blessed is the Lord God of Israel. Glorifies God first. He's visited and redeemed his people, historically, but also in the present. He's raised up a horn of salvation for us. Watch this. In the house of his servant David. That's not with reference to John, because John wasn't a descendant of David. He was a descendant through Levi. David was a descendant of Judah. So he's talking about Christ, not his son. As he spoke by the mouth of his holy prophets, that is, Jesus was prophesied, who have been since the world began, that we should be saved from our enemies physically, but more importantly, spiritually, and from the hand of all who hate us, to perform, watch this, the mercy promised to our fathers. And usually when the word fathers is used in the New Testament, it's referring to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the patriarchs. And the word patriarch is the Latin term for father. And to remember our fathers and to remember his holy covenant. Watch this, the oath which he swore to this father, Abraham. Well, what was that oath? Land, seed, blessings. But watch what Zechariah says. To remember his holy covenant, the oath which he swore to our father, Abraham, to grant us that we, being delivered from the hand of our enemies, might serve him, God, without fear, in holiness and righteousness before him all the days of our life. When Zechariah remembers the oath that was made to our father, specifically to Abraham, he doesn't focus on the land, he doesn't focus on the seed, he doesn't focus on the blessings, but he says, we're supposed to serve God in holiness and righteousness all the days of our life. That's the emphasis of the Abrahamic covenant. Not just to Abraham, but also to Isaac and to Jacob and to the nation after that. And so when Israel forgot that, God removed them from the land. He saw to it that their seed didn't multiply as it once did, and they lost many of the blessings that they had. So, chapter 18, interesting chapter. And so in this context, we see that Abraham sees three characters coming near him. And one of them, he's identified as the Lord. He prepares a meal for them and so forth. And Sarah prepares the meal at Abraham's bequest. And he is going to be told what's going to happen in the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah in the next chapter. So God's going to tell him, and the text tells us that God says, because he knows Abraham's character, he's going to let Abraham in on what's going to happen to Sodom and Gomorrah. And God says, if there are 50 righteous people in those cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, and incidentally, it's not just those towns, but all their environs, that is, villages around there. When the slaughter of the innocents took place in the opening chapters of Matthew, it wasn't just in Bethlehem, but in the regions around Bethlehem as well. So Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around about them in the plain, God says, I'm going to destroy them if there's not 50 people there. And so Abraham says, what if there's 45? God says, I won't destroy it. And then he drops down, first by fives and then by tens. And he gets down to the end, he says, what if there are only 10 righteous people there? God says, I won't destroy the city if there are 10 righteous people there. Well, the rest of the account, as you go forward, the angels go to the city in chapter 19, and the angelic beings are there. They're introduced in verse 1. They come there, and Lot was there. He sees them. He brings them into his house, and they said, oh, no, that's all right. We'll lodge in the square. He said, no, you can't do that. Lot insisted strongly. He said, you come to my house, and I will take care of you, because Lot knew the character of the people that were there. So the angels came, and before they went to bed that night, men came looking for them. And so Sodom is known because of the not just the name then, but how it's been used in the context of sexual depravity that's followed since that day has borne that name. They came looking for them. I said, no, you can't do this. And so Lot's told by the angels, said, how many people do you have here? You need to get them. You need to flee from this place because the Lord's going to destroy it. And so he goes and he talks to his sons-in-law. Remember, he flees with his wife, that's two, and his two daughters, that's four. And he asks his sons-in-law, who seem to have been married to their wives, and they don't come. They didn't follow him. So notice, he says, if there's 10, and there's not 10, there are 6 counting the sons-in-law, if that was all that was included, and they don't come. So he leaves, all right? So God's not going to spare the cities of the plain, Sodom and Gomorrah, because there's not 10, all right? Now, I want to be careful and not draw conclusions saying there's not 10 righteous people in any place on the surface of the earth, because that would be making claims that I don't know. But the point is, in large measure, during the time of the flood and during the time of this incident that we see in Genesis chapter 19, there were a lot of people who weren't doing a lot of things that God wanted. And God took note of that. There's nothing that God doesn't take note of. So in this context, Lot flees with his wife. His wife dies in the context because she wasn't faithful as she should have been and looked back. And then we see the beginning of things that are going to impact Israel in the future. And so Lot's daughters leave. And they're thinking to themselves, well, you know, our father doesn't have any descendants now. We've left our husbands behind. We're not going to have any children. And so they hatch this plot, first the older one and then the second one. They get their father drunk, and each of them lies with their father one at a time, and he has two children by them. One, Ben-Ammi, who's the father of the Ammonites, and the other one, Moab, who's the father of Moabites. The firstborn is Moab, verse 37, and the second is Ammon. Now, what's interesting is each of those two children born to Lot, who's the nephew of Abraham, are going to impact the dynamic of the nation of Israel in centuries to come. Now, think about this. There's a sense in which, and I don't mean this in trying to stretch anything, there's a sense in which we're all related. Genetically speaking, we're all related to Adam and Eve first, and then through the descendants of Shem, Ham, and Japheth through Noah. We're all related. And so all the people on the surface of the earth today are all related genetically, because we all have roots in the same sort of people. And so what's interesting is some of those genetic connections are going to come into play later when Israel becomes a nation. Some of their severest and worst enemies are going to be people to whom they're related. The Edomites, who are they descendants of? Esau. They haven't seen him introduced yet. Going to cause him a lot of grief. And the Ammonites, mentioned in this context, the progenitors of the Ammonites, Ammon mentioned here, and the Moabites are also going to cause them a lot of grief when they leave the land. And so one of the things that's interesting in the Ishmaelites, that's going to be another issue that's going to come up with reference to Abraham. And so when you think about the nations and the way the nations interact today, there's a sense in which they're all brethren because they're all connected somewhere up the tree. All right? Now that's interesting. I want to share something with you and then we're going to draw to a close. We'll start up with chapter 19 and 20 next time. I read an article written by a Jewish rabbi. And it was written after there was a huge, thing that took place in Charlottesville a couple of years ago. And he was talking about the whole notion of a supremacy of one race over another. And so this Jewish rabbi mentioned something that I thought was very interesting. He says, God created Adam and Eve. And he says, there weren't Jews. There was no such thing as Jews when Adam and Eve created. What were they? They were people. They were people, that's it. They weren't nations. They weren't members of X nation. There was no nation of the Garden of Eden. They couldn't say, well, my dad was, or your dad was, because they didn't have any physical parents. It was just them. And his point was, there was a sense of unity that existed because mankind all had a similar ancestor in the very beginning, and that similar ancestor never went away. When they divided into nations and tribes and clans and ethnicities and religions, he said they're still all related to God as the offspring of God. He says, if we would understand that, maybe we wouldn't be as much at each other's throats with reference to the things that divide us. That doesn't mean religious differences don't make any difference. That doesn't mean that political and economic and all sorts of other things don't make any difference. His point was, at rock bottom, at root, everybody's related in the same way to God that everybody else is related. And so that's part of the reason why God has this commandment we refer to as the second great commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. Why? Because everybody is just like you, even if they don't look like you. Even if they don't believe like you, even if they don't do what you do, even if they're an anathema to you from the standpoint of the things they believe and practice, you're still supposed to love them. That doesn't mean you sanction them. Doesn't mean you approve and accept everything that they do, but it still means that you love them. And so this dynamic that comes into play here with reference to the birth of Ammon and Moab are going to be thorns in the flesh as we get a little bit further. All right, so we're going to take up next time an even break, chapter 20. And I think next time, by the time next Sunday comes around, today's the 5th, 12th, we'll be up to about chapter 33. So if we get through the next 20 chapters, 10 in the morning, 10 in the evening, we'll be about 5 chapters ahead, which is where we are today. All right, let me simply say this. Are we going quickly through the text? Uh-huh. And I'm in order to get roughly 20 chapters done each week, we're going to do that. I'm trying to augment stuff on our Sunday morning lessons in our sermons by bringing out something else in addition to just serving the text very quickly. Just a reminder, in a little bit tonight when we're done, I will load the audio file that's from this class so you can listen to it again. It'll be linked. It's already linked there at the site that I mentioned before. If you didn't see that, I'll just put it up again. So when you go to, I closed it, maybe I didn't. So if you go to, thebible.net/EWG, all right, for Every Day with God, that's what you're going to see. If you click the class files link, you're going to get this, and tonight's class is already linked there. Now, if I click it, it's not going to go to anything because I haven't loaded it yet. But everything, with the exception of the class notes for Genesis, which I'm still editing, will be added. So in the next day or so, tonight or tomorrow, all of these files that are in blue will all be linked. And between now and next week, I'll work on preparing all the material that's here. It's already written, but I'll edit it again. And so you're going to have 3 to 5 files every week from now to the end of the year. Right? So my point is you're going to have a lot of stuff to study in addition to what you're reading. And I hope you're keeping up on your reading and participating in the class. All right. Last minute questions about anything related to class before we're dismissed. Yes, Pam, and then Marilyn.
I wasn't here this morning.
Yes.
And Noah.
Yes.
Blood,
yes.
Drunk,
yes.
And Ham saw him.
That's right.
And he cursed his
grandson
his
Canaan.
Son Canaan.
Yes.
Why Canaan? He wasn't the first son.
That's a good point. All right. Think about something. All right. Just remember this: the first readers of the book of Genesis wasn't Adam, wasn't Eve, wasn't anybody from Adam to Eve to Noah, wasn't Shem, Ham, or Japheth, wasn't Abraham, wasn't Isaac, wasn't Jacob, wasn't any of them. All the people that are addressed in the book of Genesis, none of them ever read the book of Genesis. That doesn't mean they didn't know what was going on because they lived through it. I don't have to read my biography to know what went on in my life, because it was my life, I lived it. But it was recorded for future generations. For future generations. So watch this, and I'm glad you brought this out. Even before the children of Israel leave the land of Egypt, as they're reading through the book of Genesis, or it's read in their presence, they're going to hear a curse pronounced upon Canaan, the name of the land that they're going. And the descendants of Canaan, the Jebusites, the Perizzites, the Hittites, and so forth, are all going to be mentioned later in the genealogy. And so that prophecy is not just against him, but prophetically what's going to happen in generations down the line, that God's going to bring a curse upon them. And the children of Israel are thinking, if they would have read this right, they would think, oh, God's already told us that the land's going to be ours because of this promise, or the curse, the absence of blessing that's going to be pronounced upon Canaan. So it wasn't directly dealing with that person's sin as much as it was prophetically about what's going to happen to their descendants when the children of Israel leave the land of Egypt. All right, so here's one of the dynamics, and I've mentioned this, and it's when we're just starting in Genesis, there are so many interconnected texts later as we read through the New Testament, that Old Testament, New Testament, that are going to refer back to what we see here. And so here, as you're reading the first time, it's like, you watch a good murder mystery, or you watch anything. You can't do this with Hallmark movies, because everybody figures them out in the first 5 minutes. All right? But if you're watching anything, and I love Hallmark movies, I laugh, and Evelyn and I make fun of them all the time, but sometimes they're pretty good. They're usually pretty clean. But when the Bible introduces somebody, and it focuses on that person for some amount of time, usually there's a reason why. That person or descendants related to that person are going to come into play later. So generally speaking, somebody who writes a good novel or does a good piece of storytelling, either in film or on television, whatever, they don't introduce characters just for the sake of introducing characters. They have some significant role to play in whatever plot that God's unveiling, major or minor. And so in this context, it looks like, well, that's an incidental thing. You know, Noah got drunk and, you know, two sons protected him and one didn't. And there's a curse pronounced on a judgment of a descendant of his. What's the point of that? Well, it comes into play later when we get into the book of Exodus, especially during the time of Joshua from the standpoint of conquest. And I'm going to make a statement that sounds a little over the top, that there's almost no name of an individual, a place, or an event that isn't named prophetically about something that's going to happen about that person, place, or event at some point later in the biblical text. All right? So when Abraham comes to Bethel, the word Bethel means house of God, place of God, a place of worship. And that's going to be used multiple times in the text with reference to not only what Abraham did, but the significance of God's blessing that took place at that time and in that place. So it shows up repeatedly. So there's a story that's often told. All right, and it comes back to the introduction of what it meant when it first was introduced. Calling attention to that again. And God would say, remember, and then he'd call a name. And he didn't have to do anything more than that. Just mention the name, because everybody knows what happened there. All right? In the New Testament, the same thing. Do you know what happened to Balaam? People scratching their head. What happened to Balaam? Oh, yeah, I know who he was. I know what he did. Same thing with reference to Cain. I know who he was. I know what he did. So they're introduced, and the story and the plot that's told about them is going to come into play as a shorthand notational way about what's going to happen in future generations. So Canaan is significant because it introduces the land of Canaan that's going to be important in a few generations. All right?
A lot of this is going to be later on.
That's correct. That's correct. No, it's not, but it's interesting to see now. It's a character's introduced in a story. Think, what's that person introduced for? It's going to show up later, all right? And that's one of the things. Marilyn, you were going to say something. Is that everything you had?
And?
Okay, that's fine. We'll you know, we get ahead sometime. But, you know, we'll stop and ask lots of questions. Marilyn.
I just noted by the time we got to Abraham that they were not having children. They weren't living.
That's correct.
More, 100 years.
That's correct. And I was going to say something about that. Abraham was surprised about, you know, how old he was and Sarah was, but just a few generations before that, in the context of the early chapters of Genesis, they were having children into their hundreds, and now they're only in the 100 plus, which is still more.
He had another wife and more children.
That's correct. And so he's married to Keturah after that and has additional children. And so here's the significance of that when you get into the New Testament. speaks about Abraham's seed, and then it says Abraham's promised seed. Ishmael was not a promised seed, nor any of the other children that Abraham bore by Keturah. So it's very selective in saying that particular child, Isaac. He's referred to as the child of promise. That's the promise that's first made to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. All right? Questions or comments? All right. Thank you so much. I will put this material up later so we'll have access to it, and I'll have the link that's up here hopefully later today or tomorrow, and I will send emails out to everybody to keep up on it. And, you know, if you have any questions or comments in or out of class, you know, feel free to email me about that.